Good morning.
Morning.
Nice to see you all on a lovely Sunday. A little humid, but lovely nonetheless. So, there are many types of Dharma talks. One type of Dharma talk I like to give from time to time, although I don't like to reduce them to types, but is just about how to do this stuff. How to do this practice on kind of a practical level. And today I would like to focus on how to do this stuff when things get really hard. How to continue to engage in your practice and find some solace and maybe even make a little bit of progress when basically you've been knocked off your feet. And maybe even how to turn your difficulties into something positive. That may sound a little familiar. Tim has talked recently about turning adversity into opportunity. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Tim and I are talking kind of about the same thing here. I think adversity is fertile ground for practice. Thank goodness we get to spend some time in the human realm where we have enough adversity to advance our practice. We often think we want to be in the God realm, but that's really no good because it's too good. And I think that in our heart of hearts, we know this. We know that it is in this world of adversity that we belong, that is right for us. And this talk this morning is going to be, I think, a lot like Dokusan. One-on-one, except it's about 40-on-one. And Dokusan, and I've explained many times what Dokusan is, and a lot of you know very well what it is, but we always have some new people, and we need to explain our basic terms, and I'm sure that the more experienced people won't mind, because your patience helps us to share the Dharma with people who are new. So Dokusan is a one-on-one meeting between a teacher and a student. Not all meetings between a teacher and a student are called Dokusan. An initial meeting may be called a practice meeting, and it may be quite informal. And Dokusan is a little more formal. Teacher and student sit pretty close together, and it happens during retreats and other times, too, by appointment. And Dokusan is an important part of our tradition. We have many stories going back many, many years of encounters between teachers and students. And I think it's one of the most important forms of support that we offer here at Zen Center. And I think it's where a lot of the really deep teaching occurs. And it's a teaching that is reciprocal. The teacher learns as well. Sometimes subjects for Dharma talks occur to me when I'm in Dokusan. I don't share any personal details, of course, outside of Dokusan, but sometimes what the student says can get me to thinking. And often in Dokusan, I am inspired by the student, and that helps me to continue to do this work with joy. And it's not unusual for a student to schedule a Dokusan appointment and say, things really aren't going very well. I mean, it happens to all of us at one time or another. Maybe something happened, or maybe it's just the cumulative effect of life's challenges. But the student may be thinking, I'm just barely hanging on here, and I'm barely keeping my practice going. And when that happens, I say, I'm so glad you made this appointment. Because clearly, although things are hard, you're not giving up. You're not saying, I don't have time for Zen practice, and I'm just going to let that part of my life go. Or I just can't take it anymore, or I'm going to drift now, or I'm just going to give up. You're not saying that. Instead, you made this appointment. And maybe it wasn't easy to do that. And if anyone here today or anyone listening to this talk online is in a tough spot right now, I would say the same thing to you. How wonderful that you did not give up, that you did not say, I don't have time for Zen practice now. In fact, you said the opposite. You said, it is time for Zen practice now, and I'm going to go and hear a talk. That reassures me. So here we are. Here we are. And we can get through this thing. So I've come up with four steps for dealing with this kind of difficulty. The difficulty of being, figuratively, knocked off your feet. And I'm qualified to talk about this because I've been knocked off my feet numerous times in my life. And yet, I've persisted. I think it happened more when I was younger, and it happens less now. So perhaps I've developed some resilience. And a lot of that resilience, I think, just comes from experience. You get knocked down, and you get up again. And you get knocked down, and you get up again, and you do that over and over. And it does get easier as you get older for a lot of people, because you know what's going on here. Oh, that again. Okay. I can do that. And a lot of that resilience, I think, comes from Zen practice. So what is it that knocks a person down? It can be a lot of different things. Sometimes it's family. Because sometimes you feel like, try as you might to grow up and leave the nest and become your own person, you find that there can be a kind of a lack of control when you are with your family of origin. And you can get pulled back in to being defined by other people. And you fear that there's a kind of helplessness there. It's like you're a child again. It can happen, particularly if your childhood, your family of origin were very difficult. Sometimes it's the state of the world that knocks you off your feet. Sometimes it's politics. I know. I talk to people. And in fact, I gave a talk fairly similar to this one about 9 months ago, just after the election, because a lot of people were suffering then. And that situation has really not gone away, and so I don't mind addressing this topic again. And being knocked off your feet can take many different forms. It can be a kind of inertia where you don't want to do anything. It can be confusion. It can be kind of intense mental activity that you have a hard time calming down. We all have really busy minds, and Zen practice is about dealing with our busy minds. Sometimes it can get really busy. So the first step of the four is an honest acknowledgement of the situation. Our practice is about seeing accurately. Steve Hagen said in his book, Buddhism Plain and Simple, the point of Buddhism is to just see. That's all. Just see. That's all. And he expanded on that a little bit. He said, Buddhism is not a belief system. It's not about accepting certain tenets or believing a set of claims or principles. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's about examining the world clearly and carefully, about testing everything and every idea. Buddhism is about seeing. It's about knowing rather than believing or hoping or wishing. It's also about not being afraid to examine anything and everything, including our own personal agendas. Not least of all, of course, we must examine the Buddha's teaching itself. So we begin with an honest assessment of the situation. And this could look like, wow, things aren't going so well. Or I think I'm having trouble sleeping. Or I think there's this thing that I'm turning to that I'm liking a little too much and it's not good for me. Or my relationship with another person is really kind of toxic, kind of not going very well. And I can't really be myself the way things are going now. So I've got to face this problem. And it seems simple. It's an honest assessment. But I know it's not so simple from personal experience, because I think we have an incredible capacity for denial. Denial is really powerful. And I know of situations when I was younger when really things weren't going very well, and I just say to myself, no, things are good, because they're always good, because that's the kind of person I am. I'm a person who always does well. And I would go to remarkable lengths to kind of preserve this fiction about myself. And to some extent, you know, we've all got that. We've all got that going. And it's wonderful, and it's true most of the time. But sometimes, when it's actual denial, it is not helpful. And I would say that to myself because that's just what I wanted so badly. And I just couldn't accept that the reality was different from the way I wanted it to be. But it's good to be honest about how things are going. But I want to balance what I've just said here, because there's another side to acknowledging the reality of the situation. And there's something we need to be careful of. And that is, especially if we have a tendency to get down on ourselves, Buddhism, again, is about seeing. That means it's about seeing the whole picture. Seeing not only your difficulties, but also your strength and your abilities and your great heart and your great intention and your great aspiration. These are an essential part of that picture as well. And there is a panoply of things you can remember. You've gotten through this kind of thing before. You have learned from your experience, and you have been resilient. You are not alone. You have friends. You have family. You have, if you come here regularly, the Sangha. And teachers. Perhaps you have a teacher. You have the Buddhas and ancestors and all beings. You have a great untapped strength. And if you don't believe that, you're just going to have to trust me on it. You have the potential of turning this difficulty into something wonderful. And you even have the potential of helping others someday who are going through this same type of difficulty. So that your work, your personal work in getting through this difficulty, is for the benefit of others as well as for yourself. You have the potential of making this not about you. There is perfection here in the midst of imperfection. And in fact, those two things are the same thing. So step one is an honest acknowledgement of the situation and both sides of the situation. And what is the second step? You might think that I'm going to urge you to do something very active here, as in, get to work, fix it, double down on your practice, make a list of things you're going to do, and devote yourself to that list with zeal. But it's not that, and in fact, it's the opposite. Step two is, get some rest. Get some rest. Because usually when you're down, knocked off your feet, messed up, ineffectual, or confused, you're exhausted as well. And it takes a little time to rebuild. Once you have assessed the situation, you know you have to do something. It may take a new approach. You may have to disrupt your routines, but you don't know what to do yet. So before you can do all of that, it's time for some self-care. So literally, getting some rest is great, if you can manage it. Of course, if you've been too lethargic, obviously this doesn't apply. Something else is needed there. Rest is not what you need. But if you've been running yourself ragged, hey, get yourself some sleep. Cancel some things. Get some downtime. Or maybe that's not possible. Maybe you just have a lot of responsibilities. Maybe you're a single parent and you also have a job. Maybe you just have no wiggle room in your schedule at all. So you think, well, I just can't rest. So what can you do then? Well, to some extent, I think getting some rest can be more a matter of your state of mind than it is a matter of scheduling. And I'm thinking of what the Metta Sutra says. We frequently chant the Metta Sutra here. And it begins, "This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be," and then there is a whole series of ways that a person who knows the path of peace can be. And one of them is unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. And I have to tell you, every time I recite that unburdened with duties, I just want to shake my head a little bit because I don't know how I'm going to manage that. And I don't shake my head a little bit because I'm usually up here at the altar and that would be kind of disrespectful. But I think to myself, how can I possibly be unburdened with duties? If that's the Zen ideal, how do I square that with the other Zen ideal, which is pretty deeply ingrained in me, of serving all beings to the best of my ability? Because that's what I do. That's the life I've chosen. And it's pretty good. I don't want any other life. This is what makes me happy. And how can I literally follow the song of the grass roof hermitage? After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. That sounds really nice. But they won't let me do that at work. I could try it, and I could pull out, when they say, what are you doing? I could pull out Ben's book, and I could say, see, it's in here. But going back to the Metta Sutra, I note that it doesn't say, let them be without duties. It says, let them be unburdened by duties. So you can't escape your duties, but you can escape the burden, right? That's the secret. Escape the burden. And how is it that you're burdened by your duties? Well, it's pretty simple. One way you're burdened by them is because you, and I say you, but I'm talking about me as well, you're burdened by them because you're thinking about them all of the time. You're thinking about your duties at times when you really can't do anything about them, and at times when you could be resting your mind. And I think we seem to have a kind of a fear that if we stop thinking about our problems for even 1 minute, then we're kind of slacking off on the job, and we're going to miss something, and we're going to miss this opportunity to do the work, and we're going to get behind, and we're going to get into big trouble. But of course, that's not true. Thinking things over is necessary sometimes. We all need to do that, but obsessing about them is not. If you find yourself going over the same ground again, and maybe just getting a little more agitated, and maybe just coming up with more speculation about what could go wrong and what you would do to fix that, then it is best just to stop. Just to stop. Take the risk of stopping. Take the risk that totally letting go of all of this activity, that it won't be a problem. See if possibly you can let these thoughts go and simply return to a place of rest through simply being where you are, no matter what it is. There are 1,000 ways to return to where you are. Pay attention to how you feel, how your body feels, how your emotions are. You can look around you in a non-seeking sort of way. You can sit. There are 1,000 ways to simply return to where you are. And I think when you do that, you will find that no disaster will ensue. At the last retreat I led, maybe a couple of weeks ago or three, I emphasized this in my talk. And I said, if you completely let go of your problems today, and you completely let go of your ideas about improving yourself, and you simply spend your time doing what you're doing, allowing the next thing to happen, and approaching it with curiosity, the worst thing that can happen is that you're going to waste about 6 hours in your lifetime struggle to improve yourself. And I think you can take that risk. I think you can get some rest. Get some rest. So when you eat lunch, eat lunch. It's a crazy, radical idea. When you see that bit of green, leafy stuff on your fork, just eat it. It has a nice texture. It's green. It has a radical shape. Maybe it looks like a little tree or something. And it has a nice flavor. And your world will not crumble just because you thoroughly enjoy that little bit of green. And in fact, if you allow yourself to actually eat lunch, you will, when you return to those problems, to those thoughts, have better energy for them. And you will be able to take a fresh look. And I think we all know this. I think we all know this, at least on some level. But it's a matter of reminding ourselves, because we get so caught up in the activity. And it's so hard to let go. And that's where meditation comes in. Because in meditation, you see these thoughts at the moment they arise. And you see that we're basically obsessive creatures at all times. That our minds are always taking off, always going, always trying to prevent us from being here in the moment. That's just how our brains work. But when you see that, when you see that going on, and you see the moment that thought arises, you realize that you have a choice. You have a choice. You can follow that obsession, or you can have lunch. And I vote for lunch. So that brings us to the third point, which is to recommit to engaging in Zen practice. And this one probably doesn't surprise you if you know me or if you know where you are. So once you've followed my first two steps, you've accepted the situation, you've honestly assessed it, and you've learned how to rest in the midst of your busy life. When you drive, you drive. When you walk. And when you have lunch, you have lunch. You then have enough energy to recommit to Zen practice in a way that will be sustainable. And maybe you take a fresh look at your practice, or maybe you go with what is tried and true. Maybe you go back to the old plan, or maybe you shake things up a little. But however you do it, please, if you can, just get on a cushion or on a chair and spend some time there regularly. Or if you're not ready for that, maybe sitting is just not working for you right now for some reason, that's okay. Then you can come to Zen Center for the services or the talks or the tea after the lecture or the work day. You can work in the yard. The best trick for Zen practice, if you want a trick, is to do it with others. Just do it. And it doesn't have to be a big deal. In fact, it's better if it's a small deal, like brushing your teeth. You just do it. You just do it every morning. You do some sitting. You just do it on Sunday. You come to Zen Center. And consider, if you haven't done it before, seeing a teacher. This talk, as I said, is a lot like Dokusan. And I'm sort of imagining a composite of a number of people who have met me in Dokusan and said, wow, I've been knocked off my feet and I'm not sure what to do. And what I'm saying to you now is the kind of thing I say to them, but in Dokusan I don't address a composite. In Dokusan I address you. And if you open up to me, I'll hear you, and I won't promise any quick answers. I won't promise any answers at all, but I'll listen to you and we'll work on it. And if you're not ready to open up right away, that's just fine. It's only natural that you'd want to get comfortable first, and I'd want to get comfortable first. I won't push you very much, unless I think it's some kind of an emergency. I might push you a little, but I'm pretty gentle, pretty gentle. And I'm not just talking about myself here, because all of our teachers are very good, and they are all very kind, and each one is a little different, and you have a choice among teachers. You can find the one that seems right for you. So, sort of recommitting to Zen practice, and now we come to the fourth and last point. And here it is. It's seeing habit energy. See habit energy. And I'm ending up here because this is one way of expressing what it means to get to the source of the problem. The source of the problem. And what is that? Well, if you've been knocked off your feet, the source of the problem, in part, is probably something external to yourself. And it may be something that you can't do anything about. Something bad that happened, or just the condition of the world. But what you can always do, of course, is you can do something about your reaction to this thing. How you deal with it. That is under your control. Or it can be under your control with some steady application. And for many of us, the thing that impedes us, that keeps our kind of obsessive mind going, that keeps us from dealing effectively with our difficulties, is habit energy. Habit energy. And that's a term I learned from Thich Nhat Hanh, and I think many of you are familiar with it. And it comes from Yogacara, and it involves seeds in our storehouse consciousness, bija. And there is a very interesting philosophy behind this. But what I would like to do is I would like to read a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh explaining what habit energy is. He says, "We are always running and it has become a habit." And that kind of encapsulates it right there. We are always running and it has become a habit. And I think we see this kind of driving force that is almost always there. It's almost always there. We struggle all the time, even during our sleep. Do you ever try to make mental constructions during your sleep, during your dreams, that have sort of nothing? There's nothing there beneath them, and you wake up about 4 o'clock and you realize you've tried to build something all night about nothing? Maybe it's just me. I don't know. I have an active brain. We struggle all the time, even during our sleep. We are at war with ourselves, and we can easily start a war with others. We have to learn the art of stopping. Stopping our thinking, our habit energies, our forgetfulness, the strong emotions that rule us. When an emotion rushes through us like a storm, we have no peace. How can we stop our fear, despair, anger, and craving? We can stop by practicing mindful breathing, mindful walking, mindful smiling, and deep looking in order to understand. But our habit energies are even stronger than our volition. We say and do things we don't want to, and afterwards we regret it. We make ourselves and others suffer. We may vow not to do it again, but we do it again. Why? Because our habit energies push us. They are very strong. So I was fortunate enough to go to a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, a 5-day retreat in Green Lake, Wisconsin. And this was, I looked it up, this was 14 years ago. And it was a wonderful retreat. It was designed for people in law enforcement, and there were a lot of law enforcement officers there. It was kind of an early event in this movement to teach mindfulness to police officers. And there were others as well, many others. And I think there were maybe about 600 people there. It was a residential retreat. There were dormitories there. Thich Nhat Hanh was there with a lot of his monks, probably over 50, maybe 70 monks, I don't know. Thich Nhat Hanh, whom people called Thay, would lecture for maybe 4 hours a day, which was wonderful. And he talked about habit energy a lot. And he talked about where these seeds of habit energy come from. And he says that we receive them from our ancestors, friends, and society. And they're held in our consciousness just as the earth holds the seeds that fall upon it. And he talked about how we have a choice as to which seeds we water. We have seeds that can produce great difficulty, and we have seeds that can produce wonderful things. And we have this choice. And he talked about how when we meet a person, what we really meet is our own habit energy, and it prevents us from seeing anything else. Perhaps when we first met this person, we had a negative reaction to him. And that becomes our habit. And every time we see him, that same idea comes into our head, and we're not seeing him, we're seeing our idea of him. Our habit energies keep us from being able to perceive the reality of the present moment. And so I was listening to these lectures that were like that, and I was immersed in this 5-day retreat, and it was remarkable, I thought, how real this all became to me. I became more aware of my habit energy, which I had brought with me. I had come from work, and I had had this long drive, and I was just ready. Okay, what's the next thing? And it's propelling me forward. I've got to be busy now. What is it I can latch on to now? And it was a low-stress retreat. It wasn't much like one of our sesshins. It was kind of, I would say, easy. There was almost no meditation. There was a half hour a day of meditation, and that was optional. There was an early morning mindfulness walk, which would be led by Thay, and everybody would go, and there'd be like 600 people doing this kind of slow walk and watching the sun come up. There was something called touching the earth ceremony, which I went to every day because I loved it so much. People sang folk songs to us. There were meetings with other participants. There were the lectures. There were 3 completely silent meals a day. And we were encouraged to walk mindfully with every step, no matter where we were going. And about 3 days in, because all of this was so powerful, I was just walking outside. I was walking between 2 buildings, and I just let go. I just let that habit energy go in kind of a deep way. It wasn't super dramatic, but it was different afterwards. I was present, and I was happy, and I was smiling a lot more. And I began to look around, and I kind of saw other people. Same thing happening to them. And probably my years of practice I had had coming up to that point helped me with that. But I saw similar changes in people who were quite new to the practice, and I thought, wow, this is wonderful. This is amazing. They have this glow, and they're not even meditating. Am I doing it the hard way here? But somehow I came back to what I'm doing here. But the important point is that somehow this very gentle and very persistent practice helped me to see this habit energy, not see it intellectually, but see it deeply and to actually let it go. So this is something that goes beyond recognizing it with your analytical mind. And that's part of it. I heard Thay's lectures. I thought about it. I recognized it with my analytical mind. I used that mind to instruct myself, pay attention to this. Here's what happens when this comes up. Pay very close attention. But what enabled me to actually let go of it was something different than that. And it was seeing in a deeper sense. When Steve Hagen talks about seeing, he's talking, I think, about that deeper sense. The analytical mind is where habit energy resides. I had to see it from another place. Otherwise, it was just habit energy seeing habit energy. And if habit energy is seen from another place, from big mind, then habit energy withers and dies, and that's a good thing. If you miss it, don't worry, it'll come back. But to be free from it is a wonderful thing. And I can't tell you how this seeing will happen next to you, but I can tell you what seems to make it happen. And it's just the things I've been talking about this morning. So I'm kind of summarizing here. Just that honest acknowledgement of how things are. When things are difficult, acknowledging the difficulty. When we've made a mistake, acknowledging the mistake. But also acknowledging all of our positive efforts and our abilities and our own kindness. To put it another way, it's the first noble truth. Acknowledging the truth of suffering, not living in denial. And at the Thich Nhat Hanh retreat, this occurred when it was very gently pointed out to me how much my habit energy was making my life difficult. Second, get some rest, some self-care. This occurred at the retreat because it was slow-paced and, in a way, easy. Third, do the practice. At the retreat, it was constant. It was low-key. It was nice. But whenever you were walking, whenever you were eating, whenever you were attending a ceremony or anything at all, you were encouraged to be mindful. And fourth, see the habit energy. See the habit energy in a gentle way. There's a little calligraphy on, a Facebook site of Thich Nhat Hanh's that says, "Dear habit energy, I see you. Dear habit energy, I see you." And sometimes we might think that we're kind of incapable of this, that we're not going to be able to slow down. That's probably not true because we're all here, right? So we all have this faith that can happen. But if it should ever happen to you, do you think, no, I can't do it. I can't do it. That's for other people, but not for me. And I remember thinking that myself a long time ago. If you think you're incapable of this, well, here's something that Thay says that makes me think, wow, habit energy really is strong. He says, if we crumple a sheet of paper, it is difficult to make it lie flat again. It has the habit energy of being crumpled. We are the same. So that's, yeah, that's kind of rough to think about that. You know, you get crumpled, and it's pretty hard to uncrumple you. You can uncrumple you, but you got kind of a mess here, and it's hard to read. And he says, we people are the same. But I don't really believe that, because I've seen the deep transformative powers of this practice. I've seen it in myself. I've seen the basic rewiring that has happened with me, and I think I've been uncrumpled. So I thought, you know, maybe paper can be uncrumpled. And so I took the paper that has the Thich Nhat Hanh quote on it, and I crumpled it up really quite severely. And you know what I did to straighten it out? I ironed it. And it looks pretty good. It looks pretty good. I can read it. It fits in with all the other papers. It's going to end up in my file with all my other Dharma talks, and it's going to be fine. It's going to work just fine. But it's going to have this incredible pattern here, which is really kind of beautiful. And so it's got a little history now. My brother Jim likes that term. Sometimes we would be working on a construction project together or something. We'd damage something, you know, like maybe we practically wreck our boots, or we saw through a board that's not supposed to be sawed through. Instead of saying, well, that's a big problem, he says, well, it has some history now. And I have to say that I love the things that have history, and I love the things that are damaged. I love the mistakes. I love the stitches in my rakusu that are a little awry. I love those the most. And I'm a little bit like this paper, and I like the lines. I like the lines. So a crisis being knocked off our feet can actually help us change in ways that are very positive. And it makes us unique, and it makes us who we really are. So if you've been in a difficult spot, please take heart, and please keep at it. Now I'm going to have to iron this one. So that's what I have to say this morning, and I'd love to hear from you if anyone has anything to add, or maybe a question. And yes, Bernie.
You mentioned the beautiful things that are damaged, and I'm losing it in my mind right now what it's called, but there's a Japanese tradition art form where they take a broken piece of pottery or a bowl, and they repair it with gold or some other form of metal, and so you can still see the cracks and everything, but it's been made more beautiful by its fracture.
Yeah.
Somebody in this room knows what that's called.
Your picture is on Facebook.
Yeah. Sounds right.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. Huh. Anyone else? If not, that's okay. We can move on to the announcements.